Hello and welcome to Joshua Space, a podcast all about books and pop culture. On today's episode, I have the absolute privilege to welcome Angie Thomas, a New York Times bestselling author of several books, including The Hate U Give, Concrete Rose, On the Come Up, and most recently, Nick Blake and the Remarkables. Thank you so much, Angie, for joining. Such a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to do this.
Yeah, so I know you've been published for several years now. And you have multiple books out. And I know The Hate U Give, when you first wrote it, it was more of a short story. And the professor that you had at the time encouraged you to turn it into a full novel. And so with that, did you ever have plans to become a novelist or an author before that experience? Or was that kind of your first dabble into the world?
It was kind of my first dabble into the world. When I went to college, I decided to study creative writing. And the school that I attended, one thing that I liked about their program was they let us study different types of creative writing. And so I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I wasn't sure what kind of writer I wanted to be. I didn't know if I wanted to be a screenwriter, a journalist, a novelist, or a poet. And so I had the opportunity over those years, 4 years, to take classes on all of those. And I just kept getting pulled to novels, and especially to young adult literature and kids lit. Even though I was being assigned books that were not young adult or kids lit, in my free time, those were the books that I enjoyed the most. And so when I wanted to write a novel, at first for my senior project, I wanted to do a whole novel. But my professor, he said, why don't you start with a short story? Because, you know, I think there are some other, if there are any writers out here, they're going to understand when I say one of the best lessons you can learn as a writer is learning to finish something.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we all start, a lot of us start stuff, but finishing is hard. And one thing that I learned in college was short stories kind of help you train that muscle for learning how to finish a book, learning how to finish a story. And so I wrote several short stories that were all connected. And that was my senior project. And those short stories were what later became The Hate U Give. But it took me like a few years after college to finally decide to write it as a novel. But even when I was writing it as a short story, writing these short stories, I kept adding stuff and making them longer than they were supposed to be, blah, blah, blah. And that professor, he kept telling me, remember, this is just a short story. We want to learn how to finish something. So yeah, it was something, it took me a while to figure out that that's what I wanted to do, but I eventually got there.
That's awesome. Obviously, at that point, the writing process for you was more writing a short story, writing multiple short stories within the same timeline, and then kind of compiling them into a novel. With your other novels, was that kind of the same route you took in writing them, or did you use like a different tool to outline and plan them?
You know, I think it's weird to say this, but I feel as if I had to learn how to write a novel with my second book more than my first one, because I laid so much groundwork with The Hate U Give, with those short stories, that when I did On the Come Up, it's like I really had to learn how to do something from scratch and learn how to tell an entire story from scratch. So it was the beginning of me figuring out my process. And it was a messy journey, I have to say. That book was the hardest book I've written. It was so hard for so many different reasons. And everybody says the second book is the hardest. And yes, I will attest to that. It was. But I really did. I had to learn again, like how to do, because I didn't have a short story to back up on. So what I did was I kind of made little short stories along the way. And that's what helped me figure out the story itself. So one thing you'll notice in On the Come Up is that there are multiple storylines. You know, you have the storyline of Bree and her journey of becoming a rapper, but then you have the storyline of Bree, the daughter and granddaughter and family and brother. Then you have her mom, and then you have the story of Bree who's trying to figure things out with these two guys. And I will say, I think writing short stories helped me to figure out how to do subplots, you know? So in a way, it did end up carrying over. So even like Concrete Rose, I learned how to, okay, let's do the short story within the story. Let's make these subplots. So it's something I've taken and I've ran with. And honestly, while talking about it with you right now, I finally realized that this is like my, this is eye-opening for me. So
that's awesome. going slightly off topic for a second, with Bree, did you put yourself into the Bree's character? Because I know in your past life, you were a bit of a rapper. So did you?
I feel like I use the word rapper loosely when talking about young Angie and her dreams. I wanted to be a rapper, but I was awful. I was not nearly as good as Bree. Yeah. I was not nearly as good as Bree, but I was like 13, 14, 15, 16. And it was definitely, I definitely took a lot of the things, well, the dreams that I had and put them into Bree. For me, wanting to become a rapper wasn't necessarily just about the art form and the creative part of it. A lot of it was, I want to help my family out of this financial situation we're in. And I don't know of any better way to do it than the way that I see people on TV doing it. You know, I see rappers with the money and the cars, and they're doing that. So maybe I need to do that to change my family situation. So I took that from my own life. And just Bree's, like, her dreamer side, that was me at that age. So I definitely took bits and pieces of it, but I was not nearly as good as she is. Like, let's not even get it twisted. I was horrible. My rap name was horrible. Everything, the whole package was just bad.
I like how you have it on your website where it says, when you talk about that and you said, you asked the question, where can I find any of your songs? And you're like, oh, thank God, they are all deleted and gone.
I will say, I found out in recent years that my mom actually has like the one demo tape that still exists of mine. And basically she's holding it like as blackmail material. Like she has the CD, like she really has it. And I'm like, oh, and she's like, mm-hmm. So I will never ever cross my mama because she's got that tape. I will never, like, oh no. So that's the best, like, anybody out there right now, if you're like aspiring to do something, but you're not sure you're good, make sure your parents don't get hold of blackmail material now, because they will hold it over your head later. I promise you. Like,
they will hold it for the rest of your life.
Yes. I mean, my mom even, and funny thing is, when I found that demo tape, I also found her stash of first print, first editions of The Hate U Give, because she found out there was a bookstore that was selling like first print, first editions for like $1,000 a piece, which is insane to me. I hate using that word, which is ridiculous to me. Let me say that. And I was like, what? And she found out, so she stashed off. And had me sign them. And I'm like, why am I signing books? What? Did you want me to, wait, what, who are these? And I find out she's got those. So yeah. Sorry, let's get back on topic.
That's awesome. So going back to writing a little bit, and because I know you have The Hate U Give, you have Concrete Rose, On the Come Up, you have A Story in Blackout, and all of those novels are young adult novels, and they're more contemporary. And your recent novel, Nick Blake and The Remarkables, The Manifestor Prophecy, is very much a middle grade fantasy. So was that something you kind of always had brewing, that you knew you wanted to write this book? Eventually this was going to happen, or how did it come about?
Yeah, it was something I always wanted to do. Even when I was in college, I played around with the idea, because some of my favorite books when I was in college were middle grade fantasy books. You know, Percy Jackson, I loved Percy Jackson. Chronicles of Narnia, all those different middle grade fantasy books. I really got into those while I was in college. I loved reading them as a kid too, and I really got pulled back into reading because of them. And so, but when I was in college, I started looking at them and I'm like, wait a minute, there aren't any Black kids like at the forefront of these. And so I considered writing something maybe about a Black girl, but then, you know, looking at the landscape of publishing, and I was like, maybe I can't. So when I got out of college, even though I wrote The Hate U Give first before I graduated, the first book I tried to get published was a fantasy book about a little white boy. And it was rejected like 300 times. And like at the 299th rejection, I was finally like, you know what? Maybe I ought to work on that book from those short stories. So I ended up doing The Hate U Give. And one thing about The Hate U Give, and also the work that had been done by so many people in publishing, like, we need diverse books and so many advocates, and even an essay written by Walter Dean Myers calling out the lack of diversity in children's literature, that all of those things, plus the hate you give, show that not only do we need diverse books, but diverse books sell. Diverse books can find an audience. Diverse books, you know, are for more than just the people who look like the character on the cover. So the success of that really helped change publishing in some ways, but it also showed me that, wait a minute, I can write about the Black girl like I wanted to do all along. So in 2020, you know, the world was totally normal.
Oh, completely.
Nothing happened 2020. Such an uneventful year. But I had a hard time just sitting down trying to write contemporary YA. I just finished Concrete Rose and it was set in 1998 and 99. So I didn't have to deal with the pandemic writing it. I didn't have to worry about that. But then when I finished it, I was like, okay, how do I write a book set during COVID? Like, if these characters want to kiss, should they have a COVID test first? Do you go on a first date over Zoom? How do you do that? And I'm like, I don't want to deal with that. And I'm thinking to myself, if I don't want to deal with it, I'm sure kids don't want to deal with the real world stuff either. So I just felt like the perfect time to finally write the story, the middle grade fantasy book that I always wanted to write. So yeah, it's something I've wanted to do for a long time. And I'm glad that I'm able to do it now. And it's been a joy. It's been so much fun. And I think that as a writer, that's what you want. You want those stories that are fun to write. And this one definitely has been.
Yeah, no, and I think especially recently, there's been such a push for diverse middle grade fantasy that it's just, yes, it's amazing to see.
Absolutely. I'm so happy too, because little Angie would have just loved all of these books that are out there now, like Omari and the Knight Brothers, The Marvelers, so many different ones out. She would have loved that. And so I just wanted to add to it, you know, because there are so many great options out there. So it's a great time to be in kids lit, period.
Yeah. And so because you wrote it during pandemic, how did that affect, I mean, obviously it affected you in the sense of wanting to switch gears from contemporary to fantasy, but did it affect your writing process in any way?
I would say a little bit. But it was more like having to expand my writing process. And what I mean by that is, even with my contemporary novels, one thing I'm proud of, it's not me trying to brag or say I'm good at it, but one thing I am proud of is that in my contemporary novels, I kind of built this world. You know, The Hate U Give, On the Come Up, Concrete Rose, they all take place in the same neighborhood. And so I got to build this world, do a lot of world building, build this neighborhood, and have threads that connect it throughout all three stories, you know, for this place to make it feel like a real place. And so with my process with this middle grade, I suddenly had to build the world even more. I have to build my magic system. I have to figure out the rules. I have to, you know, figure out what does and doesn't exist here. How do things work? And so the work that I'd done with my contemporary novels kind of prepared me for that. And also in knowing too how to hopefully make things feel real. Because even though it's a fantasy book, you still want it to feel realistic to a degree. Like, okay, yes, people are flying, but we gotta have a logical explanation for it, you know? So I would say with my process, I just really had to learn to expand it. Learn to expand the process, learn to expand my world building gears in my brain. And then too, figuring out my characters and also reminding myself that, you know, the process can be the same, because I kind of went into it thinking, oh, I gotta change my entire process. But no, because at the end of the day, I'm still writing about a kid who wants something, whose world has been turned upside down, inside out, and she has to figure out a way out of it. Same thing happens with Star. Same thing happens with Breeze. Same thing happens with Maverick. So it's no different with Nick. It's just adding the fantasy elements in.
Nice. Did you, because I know you had written a fantasy story with a white boy. Did you take anything from that story into the story and try and like fit it in at first, or did it continue to go through, or how did that go?
Here's what I did. The only thing I really took from that was I made that book a successful book series in the book. So if you read Nick Blake, You'll remember that Nick and her best friend JP, they are huge fans of this Stevie James book series about this kid. This is a fantasy book series, and that was the fantasy book. Basically, that was the character that I wrote about, and that book got rejected. So I just took that and I made it like a book series in the book.
Awesome. So you made a little Easter egg.
There you go. Yes, absolutely.
That's awesome. So with the fantasy story, did you come up with the magic system first, or did you come up with the story and the characters first?
Ooh, it was definitely the characters first. The funny thing is, Nick Blake, she was a side character in that original thing, which is when you think about it, it's sad that as a black woman, I thought I had to make a black girl the side character because I thought that was the only way a story like that could get published. I thought, because that's what publishing told me for so long that I had to be a side character. I couldn't be a main character. But I loved her so much, and I always was like, you know what? I want her to have her own book. So I decided to give her her own book. So she was like, she's been in my head since the beginning. I've known so much about this character from the get-go, and it was just a matter of figuring out the system, the magic system, the world, and the people around her. And the funny thing too is her name was Nick before I met one of my best friends, Nick Stone. So it was kind of funny how that worked out. But yeah, it she came to me first, and from there I built the world kind of around her.
That's awesome. Pivoting just for a second, because I know we talked about the publishing industry and how much it's grown. I mean, it still has a very long way to go, but how much it's grown even in the past 5 or 10 years with diversity. And like I know at the LA Times Festival of Books, there was a panel with Tahereh Mafi, and she had mentioned that when she first published her series Shatter Me, the first, I think, 2 or 3 books, she didn't have her profile picture in the book because she felt that if someone picked up her book and saw her, they wouldn't read it just because of the way she looked. And to me, that broke my heart. And I think that it's devastating that so many people feel that way when it comes to writing and comes to publishing, that we either need to be a side character or not show our face or however. And I think that one, that's devastating. Two, it's changed a lot. But have you noticed with, I mean, being in the industry, have you noticed the change at all? Like, have you felt it kind of from the inside more than like just seeing it from the outside? Because obviously I don't have a book published. I'm more of a writer or a reader. And so I'm only seeing it from the outside.
I'm seeing some changes, but I'm not seeing the kind of changes I want. I feel as if some of the changes we've seen in publishing have been done so that it looks as if there are changes happening, and there's still so much work to be done. The numbers don't lie. There still aren't nearly enough books being published about children of color, about LGBTQIA children, about disabled children. There still aren't enough, and there needs to be more. But also, in publishing itself, the people who are making the decisions need to also look a bit more like the actual world. We need to see more Black editors. We need to see more Black execs in publishing, and I think too that there's still this, I will say, for me, I know I'm privileged because of the success of my first book. But there are so many authors of color who aren't getting the push from their publishers that they should. There are so many books that are being going unnoticed. There are so many books that are being forgotten, and people are not getting there. It still at times feel as if there are a lot of diversity hires just for the sake of, and what we really need is we need, okay, I want y'all to put the big books behind these books by authors of color. I want you to put the big books behind these books by LGBTQIA plus authors. I want you to put the big books behind these books about disabled people, and then not just put the big bucks behind them, but make sure you're bringing in more and doing the big marketing and all of this and this. Because what we have seen too is a lot of times publishers throw big dollars at a project and then they don't put the big marketing behind it. They're not going all out. It's like, oh, we wrote you a check, but here, have good luck. Like, you're paying people big money just to say you did it, but are you actually getting behind those books like you should? So I think there still needs to be some changes. We still have a long way to go. And then too, now with the book bans, all over the country. A lot of authors, marginalized authors, are afraid that publishers are going to start backing off of our stories because of the pushback, because so many authors do benefit from books being sold in the school and library sector. So it's a scary time for marginalized authors because the pushback, you wonder, is it going to make them pull back? So it's time. I think this is one of those moments for publishing where it's like, okay, put up or shut up. Let's see what you're actually about. If you're really behind these books like you say you are, you know, are you going to let a loud minority dictate how you, you know, publish and how you market and how you support authors?
Yeah. So if you don't mind me asking this, how did it feel when The Hate U Give was initially banned? Because I know that's been banned in so many areas and that I can only imagine what that might have felt like. So how did you deal with that?
You know, when it first happened, well, when I first caught wind of it happening, it was in Houston, Texas. It's always Texas or Florida. But it was in Houston, a suburb outside of Houston. And I was angry. I was hurt. I was frustrated. But as the, honestly, I wasn't as angry and hurt about the fact that they banned my book. I was angry and hurt because I'm getting messages from kids, specifically young Black girls who identify with The Hate U Give, who identify with Star, and they're telling me how heartbreaking it is that this book has been pulled. And all I can think of is the message is sending to them. You know, the message you're saying is, shut up, be quiet. We don't want to hear about you, what you go through. And, you know, it doesn't matter what you're dealing with, be invisible. And I take issue with that. That's my big issue with book bans. Because it's not just you banning the books. It's the message you're sending to the young people who may see themselves in that book. You know, you don't care about them. You don't care that, you know, this book has helped so many young Black girls. You don't care about that. You don't care about them. And that's where I get upset about it. But also, it's interesting to me just how much it's ramped up in the past few years. It's been happening before, but like in the past year or two since COVID, it really went up a notch and you're seeing it more now and hearing about it more. But also it's frustrating, but what I've come to learn is that most of the time, the people who ban the book have not read the full book in its entirety. Like it's hilarious to me. But I still have hope because I know for one, young people are still going to find ways to get the book if they want to read the book. People are pushing back on this. And I know we're on the right side of history. I have no doubt about that. And I know that eventually things will work out.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things, at least, that I see a lot on Book Talk is how big banned books get pushed. And so, I mean, there's Banned Book Week, but there's so many bookstores that dedicate their bookstores to whether it's BIPOC authors or diverse authors or just focusing on banned books and getting those books out there. And I think to me, at least, I always feel like whenever a book, like there's a new book that gets banned, there's such a surge in popularity with it because so many people start talking about it. So in one aspect, more people hear about it. In another aspect, it is getting banned. And so yeah. I think it's kind of it's a hard.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not fun, but.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. But the only thing about it, too, is a lot of times we hear about the bestseller books when they're banned. We don't hear about the quiet books that have been banned. You know what I mean? And okay. That means that those books get pushed to the side. We don't necessarily see them mentioned in the articles, but those authors are being affected. You know, it's frustrating. But also, too, it's expected from people who don't want to take the time to understand anybody unlike themselves, who don't see people unlike themselves as people. You know, this behavior is expected. But what I want to see more of is I want to see more people being just as loud about keeping books in schools as these book banners are about taking them out.
Yeah. And I think at least on TikTok, it's very loud. I don't know about everywhere else, but I think it's one of the things I really appreciate about Book Talk.
Yes, I love Book Talk. I try not to interact too much because I know it'll be weird. You know, here I am with my blue check. I can't, you know, I don't want to do too much, but I love Book Talk. I, you know, one of my favorite success stories with Book Talk is Adam Silvera. Adam is one of my dear friends. I love Adam. I've known Adam for a long time, and I know how hard Adam has been going at this, how long Adam has been doing this, and suddenly Book Talk just went wild over his book. They both die at the end, and it just changed his life. And it's shown, I think what it's shown publishing is, because book talk readers are young usually, and it's shown publishing, oh shoot, there's still power in word of mouth, because that's essentially what book talk is.
Yeah.
So I love it. I wish I could interact more, but I try to, you know, I
Yeah.
don't want to cross that, you know.
I totally understand. And I think that's interesting because I feel like it keeps publishers on their toes because publishers have no control. I mean, they can
None.
pay if they want to push the send their PR packages or their books or pay people to talk about it, they can do that, but that doesn't mean that video is going to go viral. It's just by chance. And so they can put all this time and energy in this book. And all of a sudden, this other book just goes viral and it sells out, and they're scrambling because they weren't expecting it to do anything. And I think
Absolutely.
so much fun to watch.
Yes.
Going a little bit back to writing, and specifically with Nick Blake and the Unremarkables, did you know from the beginning that it was going to be a series? Okay.
I knew from jump that it was going to be a series. And the funny thing is, like, you know, there's they was like, oh yeah, 3-book series, yeah. And I'm like, no, more than that. So my plan is, you know, we get 3, maybe 4 middle grade Nick Blakes, and then we get young adult Nick Blake, you know.
Nice.
That's what I'm really excited about that. I get to do some stuff, you know, with that I wouldn't get to do in the middle grade realm. So I'm looking forward to maturing the character. But yeah, it was always a series for me. It's a story I've wanted to tell. It's a world I've wanted to show for a long time. So I'm gonna be here a little while.
That's awesome. And I love when book series grow with a character and you see them when they're younger and they grow up and you kind of watch them as they grow old. And I love that.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, so because it is still a series, is the idea to make it very much a series where you read books 1, 2, 3, 4, or are you going to make it a little more kind of standalone where you are able to jump into different areas?
Ooh, I think it'll be more of a you. It's preferred if you read 1, 2, 3, and 4, but if you jumped in at 2, 3, you'd still be okay. You know, that's the goal for me. We'll see if I actually pull it off. But yeah, no, that's the goal for me, because you just, with a reader, you never know where somebody may pick up and where they may start. And as a writer, you want to make sure that you're giving them what they need to make to keep up with the story, but also to immerse them in the world without worrying too much about what previously happened. So it, yeah, I want to make it so you can read them in order, but if you just start at 2 or 3, it's fine. It should be fine.
Yeah, I like when books. I think it's always interesting how some books it's you can easily jump into the second or third because I've done that where I have not realized that it's not the first book or even that it was a series, and I'm like, oh, this is a fantastic book, and I'm like, oh, there were two books before this.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. I only in recent years found out that one of my favorite childhood books was part of a series. I had no idea. Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry by Mildred D. Taylor. It was like my favorite book as a kid. I had no idea it was a series. And I think there was a book before Roll of Thunder, and I was like, wait a minute, what? So yeah, no, I've definitely dealt with that with books.
Yeah, so have you reread that series recently or like in the past several years?
I reread Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. I actually got the name Maverick from that book. But I haven't read the series yet. I'm like, you know, I'm going to, I will. But yeah, I haven't yet.
Awesome. So there was one other question that I had that's a little bit off topic, but I think in the times we're living in, it's very on topic. When it comes to AI, artificial intelligence, we're seeing the WGA is currently on strike when it comes to, I mean, obviously they're on strike for a multitude of things, and one of the things is AI and AI writing. And how do you, because I know some people are using it as a tool, some people are completely against it. How do you feel when it comes to AI? Do you feel like it could potentially be used as a tool or something to just avoid, or how do you feel about it?
I think we better get a hold of it and figure out if we're going to use it, if it's going to become part of our lives, we need to figure out to what extent early on, before it becomes too wild. With writing, I think somebody said something earlier on Twitter that really stuck out to me, and it was, people need to ask themselves, Do you want to be a writer, or do you want to say I have written? Because there's a difference. You know, are you in it to say you did it, you got a book out, or do you actually like the process? Because I don't trust AI to write complex emotional stories, at least not yet. And it could be at a point that it does, but I think there's something we want to maintain the humanity of our stories and not give that up to a machine. We've given so much to machines. Can we please, you know, keep something human? And so, but I think it can be a useful tool. It's just a matter of how we use it. I never want to be one of those people who's like, oh, that's new technology, blah, blah, blah. If there's a way we can use it, you know, to help, then so be it. You know, I will use it to create storylines for my Sims, you know, but not for my book.
Exactly.
I'll use it for the Sims 4, but not for my book. I feel like I'm cheating my readers if I do. It's going to be interesting to see, and it's going to be interesting to see how the industries, both Hollywood and publishing, respond. Because you say you value creatives, you say you value people in our work, show it, you know, or are you going to use this new technology as an easy way out? And I think all of us deserve better than a story or story books or movies or TV shows that are created solely by a computer without any kind of humanity inserted in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think it's interesting to watch it kind of playing out, especially because there's the writing aspect, and then you also have the AI art. And kind of, I know that's another thing when it comes to like book covers and movie posters and things like that. And so it's interesting to see how people react to it and how the industry's kind of maneuvering between this. It's going to be interesting to watch it play out.
Yeah, and it burns me to know that there are authors out there who are using AI for book covers. It's like, do you want AI writing your book? No, then pay a freaking artist, an actual artist, and don't use AI for a book cover. We want our work to be respected, so respect an artist's work. I'm so grateful for all of my cover artists, because I promise you, I don't have a lick of drawing talent in me. I can only do stick figures. So I'm so thankful for the people who put my covers together, and I would not want to leave that, or I would not want to cut them out of the process and leave that up to a machine. So, hey, any authors out there, stop using AI. There are some great artists out there who will do covers for you.
Yeah.
Pay them what they deserve, but
Yeah, I agree. And I know, like, there was a book, I'm not going to mention the title because I don't want to like start anything, but there was a traditionally published book recently that came out that had AI art. And when it came out, it was by one of the big five, and they had announced the cover a few months ago. There was a huge uproar, and people kind of like, even now, they go off in comments, and they did the thing where everyone starts rating the book one star, and strictly because the AI art, which in one aspect, yes, I don't agree with using AI art for a cover, but also don't like bomb the author's reviews just because of that. Like, that, it's not necessarily the author's fault, even though like the author has some say. Not all authors have a lot of say when it comes to the covers.
Absolutely.
And what really got me is I made a video talking about the book, just, and I put a disclaimer, like, I don't support AI art, but I talked about the book in a video, and someone made the comment how they can understand indie authors using AI art, but they trad publishers should never use it, and trad authors have no right to like use AI art, blah blah blah. And to me, I'm like, indie authors have more of a say so in their covers.
Exactly.
But it's a hard line, because how much are you willing, if you're not a big name author — this one was — but if you're not a big name author, how much can you really push back? You can't push back on trad.
Yeah, and I think too, and it's scary to do the pushback if you're not, you know, it's scary to speak up and say that this isn't right. I think it's going to boil down to publishing, just stop doing — I almost cursed — but stop doing awful things, you know. No, just stop. Just pay artists.
Now we'll get to the fun part of this podcast. So I know you mentioned one of your favorite books already, but do you have like top three favorite books of all time?
Ooh, top three favorite of all time. So yeah, Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry is number one. Then I would have to go with, ooh, you're making me think. I had too much brisket for this. The Bluest Eye, Toni Morrison. And then one more. One more top three all time. I feel like I'll go. I did a kid's book though.
I love putting authors on the spot with this question.
Yeah, no. This is, yeah, you definitely put me on the spot. I'm going back and forth between some books. So, but I'm gonna get there. I'm gonna just say top three. Okay, Roll of
You can
Thunder
have a
in my
couple
heart.
tied for the third spot if you want.
No, that's cheating. That's cheating. I'm not gonna do that. I'm not gonna do that. Ooh. I'm just gonna go with, and people are gonna be like, what? But I'm just gonna say, The Rose That Grew from Concrete by Tupac, because y'all know I love Pac. But also, it was for me, it was my reintroduction to him as a poet and not just as an artist, a rap artist. And those poems, that book of poems really affected me big time. Oh, the other one would have to be the autobiography of Malcolm X, because it radicalized the heck out of me while I was at my mostly white upper class private Christian school in Mississippi. So, yeah. There you go. There you go.
That's awesome. And the other one I have is, if you were not an author, if you ended up taking a different path, what would you be?
We're not an author. I would be a screenwriter or attempting to be a screenwriter. That's something I loved. I used to write scripts for fun, soap opera fanfic. I loved the show called Passions. I used to write Passions fanfic. I even found the number for a writer on Passions to ask him how to become a soap opera writer. And he was like, oh, no, honey, don't. So, no, I wanted to be a screenwriter. Or if I wasn't a screenwriter, if it was like nothing with writing at all, this is going to sound super weird, but I would probably want to be a dermatologist or like an esthetician, only because I love watching pimple popping.
That's
It's
awesome.
pitiful. It's awful. It's horrible. I know. It's like, ooh, but like, I used to want to be a doctor as a kid. And then when I got older, I was like, ooh, I don't like blood. But I can deal with blood with like that in that kind of way. So I'd be like a dermatologist or esthetician, something like that.
That's awesome. I love that. It's like completely opposite.
Completely different, completely opposite. Like you would not expect that, but oh my God. Like, what do I watch before I go to sleep? Pimple popping videos, like Dr. Pimple Popper, all of that. I watch it. So it puts me to sleep. It is the strangest thing, I know. So.
So the last question I have for you is, if you could give any advice to a aspiring author, to someone who, whether they're at the very beginning stages or they have finished writing their book, what advice would you give to them?
Oh, my biggest piece of advice for any writer out there, aspiring, just about to be published, just got an agent, whatever. My biggest piece of advice is perfection is the enemy of progress. First of all, there's really no such thing as perfect, because what you consider perfect is not perfect to somebody else. Don't aim for perfect, aim for progress. It kind of goes back to what I talked about earlier, like the biggest hurdle at times for a writer to overcome is learning to finish something, learning to complete something, learning to write the end. And if you're aiming for perfect, you will never get the progress to get to the end. So, don't aim to be perfect. Aim to get it done, because the wonderful thing about writing, there's this thing called revising, and it's great. You can fix everything. Know that every book you've ever read started out horrible. My first drafts are horrible. But it's okay, because I know I'm going to revise and edit later. So don't aim for perfect, aim for progress. And also, I'd add too, you may get a lot of no's along the way as somebody who got 300 of them, but it only takes one yes to change everything. So go for the one yes. And then, last little bonus piece is read. If you want to be a writer, one of the best ways to learn how to write is read, and read widely.
That's awesome. I like that. Aim for progress, not perfection. Thank you, Angie, so much for joining. It was such a pleasure to have you on today's episode. I cannot wait for the next book in the Nick Blake series. So thank you so much for joining.
Thank you. This was fun.